We have our discussion period. We had to change the schedule for the question and answer time for Dr. Carson. It was scheduled for tomorrow. We have it this morning now. We would like there to be some ground rules, although it doesn't seem to make a lot of difference at Bunyan. But at least pretend to try to keep the questions relevant and of general interest to everyone here. Was that a waste of my breath? We'll start with the first question from John Riesinger, and that is, Dr. Carson, would you elaborate a little more on what you did last evening on chapter 7, verses 11 and 12, regarding the law being changed and the priesthood, in special reference to the commentaries that give reference to the change only of priestly code or something to that effect?
before I answer anything, I would like to give public tribute, I'm sure on behalf of just about everyone here, to those who have been responsible for leading us in singing and so on as well. Isn't it nice just to be able to... I include not only Paul, I don't even know who this lady is over here, but there's not everyone who can play the piano in such a way that you feel that the whole congregation is being brought along. Do you know? I don't know who you are, but thank you. John. Riesinger, that is, not the evangelist. The problem with the view that chapter 7, verses 11 and 12 merely have to do with the cessation of priestly function is that it's not what the text says. Apart from that, there's no problem with the view. In fact, what the text actually says in the parenthetical argumentation of verse 11 is that the law covenant is predicated on the priestly function, so much so that when the priestly function changes, verse 12, the law must change. And then when you see that that's what the whole argument is, and then that it's confirmed likewise by the argument of chapter 8, it seems to me that once you've seen it, it's very difficult to make the text mean anything else. It takes the imposition of a very, very strong external system to domesticate the text in that particular way. Now, that does not by itself establish what lines of continuity and so on that there may be. That's a slightly different question. But in terms of the covenant, the Mosaic covenant itself continuing, quite clearly it doesn't once the priesthood changes. That's the whole argument. So that has to be incorporated into your theology, whatever shape your theology has. Well, if there are no more questions, we'll all have an early coffee.
Is the implication in that parenthesis then that the old covenant law was more concerned with getting rid of sin than it was with identifying sin? In other words, the priest, you understand what I'm saying.
Why is the right wing of the airplane more important than the left wing of the airplane? I mean, why must the thing be cast in terms of antithesis? Why not say that the law has multiple functions? Among those functions are pedagogical, to teach people something of the distinctions that God makes, that God alone is sovereign. Pedagogical, eschatological, in the sense that the argument of Galatians 3, it's our schoolmaster to lead us to Christ. It multiplies sin. It has that negative function. But then it also has a propaedeutic and pedagogical function in that it provides a whole sacrificial system that is itself prophetic and looking forward to the ultimate sacrifice of sin, the ultimate temple, the ultimate priest. It's doing all of those things. And so I don't even know how to begin to answer a question that asks, is it more this or that? I mean, it's all of those things together. And they, in terms of the internal genius of the old covenant, seems to me they stand or fall together.
I'm sure you're right. I'm not arguing. But the question really has to do with why did he pick out priesthood and not morality, for instance?
Yeah. In part because of the exigencies of what he's dealing with when he's writing to the Hebrews. I mean, all sides acknowledge that most of the New Testament books are primarily occasional. And therefore, some of the agenda is dictated by the pastoral concerns of the immediate of the immediate exigency. And clearly what's going on with this particular group, you're dealing with Christian Jews, Christian proselytes, who are tempted to go back to the whole priestly system. And yet, for him, that is not only a slur on Christ and his sufficiency, it is a failure to understand how the whole Old Covenant Scripture is put together. So, in the providence of God, it becomes thus part of the canon that teaches us how to read the whole Bible and so on. But to try to infer from that priestly matters are more important than moral matters would be a huge mistake. I mean, it just doesn't follow. Or to try to infer the opposite doesn't follow. It's just not what the book is concerned about. I mean, it's trying to make texts answer questions that they weren't set up to do. And it seems to me that is the flaw of a great deal of systematic theology. And that's not a slur against systematic theology, so that we mustn't have systematic. It's just saying that's often where systematic theology has a wheel come off, by forcing texts to answer questions that they weren't designed to answer.
Dr. Carson, I first want to say thank you for your diligent ministry in the Word.
It's a privilege to be here.
It's been a blessing to me.
The way it works, you see, is I'm not a priest. You may think of me as a stomach. Because according to the Bible, you know, we're all the body and we all have different functions in the body. And my job as a stomach is to take in nutrients and then sort of distribute the nutrients to the rest of the body. I've just lost all my dignity from now on. You see me at the front? Oh, it's the stomach again, you know?
I have two questions. They're unrelated. The first, as you model to us, I'd be interested in to know why you use the NIV translation in your preaching. Second question, last night you mentioned 20 perhaps of categories that run through the scriptures, God's rest being the one you were talking about. I'm not asking you to list all 20, but if you could maybe elaborate on a handful of those of those major categories that you see running through thematically.
Oh, yeah. That latter question is a really important one. It could easily occupy the next hour, and that wouldn't be fair, to other questioners. But it really is an important question. But it includes things like sacrifice, city/Jerusalem/New Jerusalem, temple. I mean, you think of the temple. You start off with a sacrificial system, and eventually you have the tabernacle, then the temple, the exile, and think of all the various steps along the line. When the glory of God in Ezekiel, the vision of 8 to 11, departs from the temple, and the place is shut down, and then God says in chapter 11, it's not as if the temple is destroyed. I will be a sanctuary to my people. You see, and then that moves on to the beginning of the second temple after the exile, all the way to Jesus saying that he is the temple. And then how temple is used in the New Testament, usually for the whole church of God, occasionally for our individual body, until you finally come to the new heaven and the new earth, and the new Jerusalem is built like a cube. That is, the whole new Jerusalem is the most holy place, which is precisely why then the seer can say, I saw no temple in the city, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. And in other words, you're done with mediation. You're always and forever, everyone, always in the presence of the Lord without a priest. Those are whole themes, you see, that run right through the scripture. And so if you're preaching from Ezekiel and you have the abandonment of the temple, it's wrong somewhere along the line if you don't explain how that thread cuts both ways through the scripture, so that you give at least a few minutes to explaining how it runs through, so that people can bring the whole storyline together. Do you see? And then there are other things like the repeated statement that you get under the different covenants. I will be their God, I will live among them, they will be my people. I mean, you get that kind of thing in Leviticus with respect to the placement of the tabernacle. You get it under the terms of the new covenant, and it comes out in triumphant climax in Revelation 21:22. But in each case, it's ratcheted up. And with the ratcheting up, there is a new level of sort of type, anti-type fulfillment that goes on. So it's that sort of thing that I have in mind. Constitute the structures that hold together the highly diverse literary forms that constitute the Bible, and they give you the the linearity of the Bible's plot line and enable you to put the pieces together. So I think that they are essential in helping Christians with worldview formation. One of the things that's very noticeable today is that we've got a lot of Christians, partly because there are not so many Christians reading their Bibles, but we have a lot of Christians today who think bitterly. They've got a piece here and a piece there, and they're edified by this or edified by that, but they don't think worldviewishly. And the trouble is that morality emerges out of worldviews. So if people don't think worldviewishly, and they think bitterly, there's much less likelihood of them constructing in their own minds and their own habits a consistency in rights and wrongs, a consistency in moral values, a consistency in goals and priorities and so on. There's a desperate need for worldviewish thinking. Up until 30 or 40 years ago, there was a fair bit of Judeo-Christian worldview still part of the heritage of the mental apparatus of the Western world. But with that disappearing, it becomes part of the preacher's job to reconstruct it again for our own people, and so that they will stand out against the sliding worldviews that are all around us. And part of that is done by making sure that people have the big picture. And postmoderns like narrative. They don't like the meta-narrative. That is the big picture that explains all the little pictures. But you can't make sense of the Bible unless you keep the big picture in place. So that this is really a way of getting at what the philosophers call the maintenance of the meta-narrative. Otherwise you lose the big picture, and all you've got are choppy little bits that are fitted somewhere into somebody's grid but are not worldview transforming. It's probably much too much for the question, but that's the concern. Why do I use the NIV? First of all, because it's the Bible most widely used by English speakers around the world, and by far. I wrote an article about 12 years ago where I wrote to all the major Bible publishers and asked them how many they had sold of all the major versions. And I've forgotten the exact figures now, but I mean, at the time, NIV was something like 40 million, and the closest competitor was, I don't even remember what, RSV with 3 million or something, you know. NASB was about 1.2. Granted that I speak in various parts of the English-speaking world, you want to start with the Bible that's most likely to be on most people's laps. That's part of it. Moreover, some of the press that is coming out of the right wing now against the NIV and against the TNIV is linguistically very uninformed. I don't mind if somebody wants to use the new ESV in all kinds of conservative circles where they're more comfortable with more conservative language and so on. But those aren't the circles that I primarily move in. I'm doing university missions. And when a text actually is referring to men and women and says only men, it is an offense. It is bad translation. And in that case, I'd much rather use the NRSV or the TNIV. So in any case, I'm doing my study of the Greek and Hebrew. You know, so that I'm quite happy to unpack what needs to be unpacked as I go along. But I don't need unnecessary hurdles cast up in front of me when I'm confronting people on university campuses. So I insist that the students at the seminary learn to use their Greek and Hebrew. And apart from that, I don't like translations demonized by either the left or the right. Use what's wise and ministerially, pastorally astute, and let's cool the rhetoric a bit.
Dr. Carson, John Owen, in his commentary on Hebrews, he makes the comment that the quotations of the Old Testament there is a more difficult problem than the warning passages. And I simply want to ask you, with relation to the hermeneutic that is used there, to what degree that is very distinctive, and for him, the author, to use and not us, and also to what degree the use of the Old Testament Hebrews is the same or different from the quotations, say, in Matthew?
Second question first. In my view, the two most difficult New Testament writers in terms of their use of the Old Testament are Matthew and Hebrews. I don't know if you've ever read John Broaddus's commentary on Matthew, 1886, great old Southern Baptist Reformed type. It's a great commentary in many ways, but when he gets to passage after passage after passage in the Old Testament, He says things like this. I don't have a clue what Matthew's doing here. You know, the Lord must mean it because, I mean, it's his word, so we accept it, but I don't understand it. And he goes on. I mean, that's what he says in passage after passage, words to that effect, which is a lot better than saying, this doesn't make any sense, therefore Matthew is a twit. I mean, it's at least reverent, you see. But on the other hand, one of the things that I resolved to do when I was writing my Matthew was to devote a disproportionate amount of energy and time and space to addressing those questions. They have interested me for 30 years. And so in my Matthew commentary, there's a vastly disproportionate amount of space devoted line for line of text every time you have these fulfillment passages. And for the last 15 years, I've taught two PhD seminars constantly, bringing PhD students through all the places in the New Testament where the Old Testament is quoted or alluded to, just passage after. They have to write papers, and I collect them all, and so I learn from them, you see. And eventually I'll have it sorted out. But the fact of the matter is, I think that there are some huge patterns that you can discern. The New Testament uses the Old Testament in a lot of different ways, and that shouldn't be too surprising. I mean, sometimes it's merely picking up phrases and so on without heavy overtones. Sometimes it is direct, literal fulfillment of a specific verbal prophecy. Very often it's a typological fulfillment of some sort. That depends, in some cases, on a certain salvation historical sequencing, like we've seen. And if you push me far enough, I would want to say that the most formative patterns that you find in the New Testament, you can already find in the teaching of Jesus. So that on the long haul, I would want to argue that the fundamental principles of hermeneutics are taught by Jesus himself implicitly in the way he handles Scripture. I don't know that I would agree with Owen that the apostasy passages are particularly difficult in that regard. I doubt it. I mean, they have their own difficulties, we'll see tonight.
He said they were less difficult than the hermeneutic matters with the Old Testament.
Oh, I see. I'd forgotten that. It's been a long time since I've looked at Owen on Hebrews. I think that once you've seen the pattern in Hebrews, the pattern isn't all that difficult. It's just that people have got to see it to begin with, because it's so out of sync with the way we normally think. So I don't know how you gauge those questions of more difficult, less difficult. I really don't know how to answer that. One of the reasons why it's been difficult to get people to see the pattern, I think, is because in the past there has been a great deal of uncontrolled, really slightly foolish typology. And almost by way of reaction, therefore, people become unused to the way these things have worked. And then for about 30 years, we've had a lot of scholars, good people, you know, reverent people, who have constantly drawn attention to the mechanics that are involved. That is, the way the New Testament writers quote the Old Testament, it is argued, is exactly the way the Jewish writers do. So the Jewish writers had their midot, their rules of interpretation. Kal vaHomer, which is sort of an a fortiori argument, and Gezer HaShoah, which is a kind of word link. So they had all these things. And you can show that they're being used in the New Testament. And at a certain level, those sorts of studies are right. Earl Ellis has been doing it for a long time and so on. What you miss in it, however, is the answer to this question. Granted that Jews are following certain rules for how you understand the Old Testament, granted Christians are following certain rules for answering the Old Testament, if they're the same rules, why do they come out with different answers? Do you see? That's the question you've got to ask. And some of that was addressed, in fact, by Doug Moo in a book about 30 years ago, where he said that not only do you have different sort of rules of appropriation, but there are different fundamental hermeneutical assumptions that are brought to the text. That's part of it, too. But what I've come to realize with more years plugged into it is that one of the big distinctions between the New Testament writers' use of the Old and our and the Jewish use of the Old was not in the particular rules, the particular techniques that are used to appropriate it. But this isn't the only difference, but it's one of the most fundamental differences. The New Testament writers, where they're diverging in their interpretation from the Jews, very, very often are insisting on reading the Old Testament sequentially. The New Testament writers are reading it flatly. Let me give, do you want an illustration of that? I mean, it's really quite an important issue. If you asked a first century conservative Palestinian Jew, how do you please God? He would have said, well, by obeying the law, and quoted long sections of Deuteronomy. How did David please God? By obeying the law. How did Isaiah please God? By obeying the law. How did Moses please God? By obeying the law. How did Abraham please God? By obeying the law. And you say, wait a minute. The law comes after Abraham. Oh, well, I mean, Genesis says that Abraham obeyed all of God's statutes. That's what Genesis says. What are those statutes? It must be the law. I mean, you must conclude that God gave a private revelation of the law to Abraham because he obeyed all of God's statutes. And later on, he's declared to be a friend of God. And we know that how you please God is by obeying the law. I mean, the law tells us that. So Abraham must have had a private revelation from God. How did Enoch please God? By obeying the law. Now, wait a minute, he's only seventh from Adam. Yeah, I know, but he walked with God. What does it mean to walk with God except by obeying the law? And so, I mean, that's what was literally argued, you see? Now, notice what you're doing here. What you're really doing is elevating Torah to the place of hermeneutical control. That's really what you're doing. And along comes Paul, and he is arguing, in effect, in Galatians 3, for example, that you've got this wrong. You see, a lot of the Reformed tradition, not all, but a lot of the Reformed tradition has misunderstood Galatians 3 for another reason. It reads Galatians 3 in purely a privatized form, so that the law comes along psychologically, individually, in a private fashion, to lead you to Christ. What you must have is conviction of sin first, and it leads you to conviction of sin, and then you have the gospel. But that's not Paul's argument at all. Paul's argument is a salvation historical argument, namely that you can't read the law as having that much hermeneutical control in the Old Testament because there's a promise given to Abraham first, and the promise isn't set aside, and it's 430 years later, and all these temporal things, you see? Now, the fundamental difference, therefore, that makes Paul diverge hermeneutically, reading the same text from his Jewish brothers who are getting standard Jewish answers, is in fact that he's reading the Old Testament text salvation historically. And they're not. They're reading them, this is anachronistic, systematically. That's not quite fair, because the term has got some overtones for us. But what they're doing is they're reading the Old Testament text in a way in which they've elevated Torah to the place of hermeneutical control over the whole, you see? Now, what I'm saying is that the rudiments of that of Paul's way of reading it are found in Jesus. And you've got exactly the same thing now operating in Hebrews, very, very strongly, where the argument turns on salvation historical sequence. And that is what is forming the divergence, you see, from the standard Jewish interpretations. Does that make sense?
Certainly does. I thank you for that. One thought is that what I have found at times is some people, therefore, using what is done in Hebrews with the Old Testament, therefore, as a rule to apply pretty well to the way they handle Scripture in general. And I sometimes wonder whether that can be a dangerous process to follow.
Well, if we had time, I think I could show you that Hebrews uses the Old Testament half a dozen different ways. So to choose only one of them and make it the universal is another systematizing that is illegitimate. I mean, the immediate context has first control, and then the larger book context and the corpus context and the canon context, you see? The book of Revelation, for example, uses the Old Testament least of all and most of all. Least of all in the sense that there is no fulfillment quotation, none, and only two or three extended clip quotations, the Trishagion, the thrice holy, 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 which comes out of Isaiah 6 and so on. But not many, that's about it. On the other hand, it's hard to read any two verses in the book of Revelation without finding clips, words, expressions, phrases, and so on that are drawn right out of the Old Testament. But they're used in highly diverse ways, at least half a dozen different ways, sometimes just picking up language. I mean, I was brought up on the King James Version, of course. I mean, that's the generation I was in. And so in English, in the English side of our home, we used King James Version. The French side, we used Louis Segond. And my father had this way of quoting texts at us when he wanted us to do something. If we were rabbiting on about something we didn't know anything about, which was pretty common, he would look at us and say rather witheringly, "He wist not what to say, so he said." Now, nowadays, nobody even knows what "wist" means. But in fact, of course, it comes from the quotation comes from the Transfiguration scene where Peter doesn't know what to say, so he says. You see, but there's no way that my father was saying by this, "You are thus reenacting the Transfiguration scene all again in a greater antitypical fulfillment." I mean, he was merely using the biblical language to give us a verbal upbraiding. Do you see? And so sometimes you get the New Testament writers too that are just using the biblical language without any demonstrable carrying over the Old Testament context. And then there are other places where there's direct fulfillment, and other places where there is a ratcheting up. Other places, because it's apocalyptic literature, and apocalyptic literature regularly mixes its metaphors, you come, for example, to the depiction of the four living creatures in chapter 4 of Revelation, and he's fused some elements of the seraphim in Isaiah 6 with the cherubim in Ezekiel 1. And they're neither one nor the other. And this is not because he thinks that these angels are sort of half-breeds. It's the way apocalyptic language works, that you can mix your metaphors like that. He wants you to call back images of both. He doesn't want you to draw pictures of them. And so how the language works, you see, depends a bit on genre considerations and so on. It's a little more subtle than those who simply get one insight and then stamp it on the whole Bible everywhere.
Thank you very much.
Yes, he wist not what to say, so he said. It's almost a definition of a Q&A period, isn't it?
Thank you, brother.
Yeah. I was referring to the answer part of it.
Oh. Yeah. Meat's for the stomach and the stomach for meat,
that's
but God shall destroy them both.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. And you know what he's really referring to by the stomach there, too, don't you? Yeah. Well, if you don't know, go and look it up in privacy. It's not the sort of thing you talk about in public.
The question I had related to what degree do you see the self-realizing eschatology of the now and not yet to be prevalent in Hebrews?
Yeah, that's a very important question, and it is a much disputed one. It's not an easy one to answer. No one doubts that you have both elements. No one. I think that there is a great deal of inaugurated, realized eschatology in Hebrews, already hinted at by a kind of Hebrews version of the heavenlies that you get in Ephesians. Hebrews has all kinds of very interesting links with other New Testament books. It's got lots of links with John, for example. But in this business of Christ in the heavenlies, the closest New Testament book to it, I think, is Ephesians. And the heavenlies becomes a kind of spatial equivalent of a temporal realized eschatology. So Christ is already in heaven, and we are already in chapter 12 gathered around him in heaven. The real gathering of the church is really the assembly around him in the New Jerusalem, which is already in principle taking place, even though we're stuck down here. And so I think there's a huge amount of that. At the same time, there is this anticipation of consummation still to come. That's pretty strong as well, even in notions of perseverance to the end. And then in the last chapter, notions of anticipation of the end and so forth too. and the threats of judgment, but only a bitter anticipation of the end in chapter 10 especially and so on. So the book of Hebrews is very realistic about a heaven still to be gained and a hell still to be feared. I don't know you, but there might be a question behind the question. Does this have some bearing on Sabbath issues? Is that what you're thinking?
No, not especially.
Oh, I see.
Although I do believe that's implicit, as you pointed out last night. One of the things that because of the focus on the new covenant that's so obvious in Hebrews, in the light of the anticipation of that, the promise of that, and the prophets, and of course, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, but even in Isaiah, when Isaiah in the Book of Comfort section talks about forget the former things, behold, I'm doing new things, it seems to me that the writer, of course, under inspiration in Hebrews, presents the new covenant as the covenant, of course, the eternal covenant, Hebrews 13:20, but the covenant of the age to come that has been brought into this age so that we have tasted, as Hebrews 6 says, the powers of the age to come. And all that is at work in our Lord's teaching about the kingdom is somehow worked out in his teaching about the new covenant, so that we have really that inaugurated eschatology, self-realizing, I'd prefer, over against realized or thoroughgoing, you know, as far as the three categories. And it seems that he's working this out, again, in the idea that the age to come has inserted itself into this present age, and we see that preeminently in the new covenant that we now enjoy the fruits of, but of course look for the consummation of. Could you interact with that even maybe a little bit?
I agree with that, so long as it's not elevated to the point of controlling theme. Mm-hmm. That is, it's certainly one of the themes. But on the face of it, that theme is subordinate to his more urgent concern to explain the relationship of this new covenant not to eternity, but to the past. Yeah. Now, granted that, then I agree with all that you've said. Okay. And I mean, one of the interesting things about Hebrews is that it uses a whole lot of categories that sound an awful lot like something somewhere else. Even the opening verses, where Jesus, in the past, God spoke to the fathers by the prophets. In these last days, He has spoken unto us, and we owe. It's different from John 1. But there's some parallels to John 1, where in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was... And then likewise, in the heavenlies, it sounds a bit like Ephesians, but it's different from Ephesians. And I would want to... And there's likewise some similarities on Passover passages and some others with Paul. Ephesians is one of those books that has overtones of a lot of other New Testament books, but in each case doing it a little bit differently. The language is a bit different. And I would want to argue that in some ways, the eschatology passages in Hebrews are redolent of kingdom language in the Synoptics, without quite using that language very much, and transmuting some of that stuff rather more into covenant. But very similar notions of, I mean, the kingdom language in the Synoptics likewise is bound up with the eternal consummated kingdom that has already broken into this time. And so the church is to see itself as an outpost in time of the consummated glory that is still to come. I mean, that's part of the vision of inaugurated kingdom eschatology in the Synoptic Gospels. And in some ways, that's worked out in Hebrews in slightly different language, more bound up with covenant. But the author's first concern is not primarily to deal with that. I mean, he deals with that as a subset, it seems to me, of explaining how this fits into all of antecedent revelation. Is that fair?
Yes. That's what I wondered, in what degree does that as a theme appear, of course not in a dominating way. Thank you.
Yesterday in the first session, you finished talking about the rest of God. And in verse 10 says, "For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works as God did from his." You said God's the primordial example. In what way is the person who enters God's rest ceasing from his work like God ceased from his?
Well, obviously there are differences in the sense that our work is not the creation of things ex nihilo. So it's not as if, you know, by entering into salvation I stop creating things ex nihilo or something like that. But I think that the point is, in the context of a book that is emphasizing the importance of Christ's sacrifice over against all other claims for everything, then entering into Christ's rest means we stop presenting any of our works. We stop from our works precisely in the sense that we view them as the basis in which we enter into anything in God. I mean, it becomes a kind of Hebrews equivalent of Paul, in which salvation is not by works, but it's by grace and the finished cross work of Christ. I think that's the point that is made. But there's a primordial modeling even in God in this respect. Interestingly enough, the whole debate on whether or not God ceases from his works likewise has interesting ramifications elsewhere in the New Testament. Take a look at John 5. You see, in John 5, 1 to 15... Jesus heals the man who is paralyzed at the pool in Bethesda and then tells him to take his mat and go home. So he rolls it up, put it on his shoulders, walks away. And then the man and then Jesus get clobbered by the critics for breaking Sabbath controversy. And then when he's confronted, verse 16, because Jesus was doing these things is probably generic, both the healing on the Sabbath and telling the man to go and carry his mat home on the Sabbath. The Jews persecuted him. Jesus said to them, "My Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working." So was God working or was he at rest? Now, that's a very interesting passage because there's a whole Jewish debate behind it, in fact. The Jews broke up the categories of work for convenience sake, into 39 categories of prohibited labor by the New Testament times. It's wrong, for example, to carry anything from one house to another. So if you're on the Sabbath, you can carry something within your own house, but not from one house to another, because that could easily fall into one of the categories of prohibited work, do you see? And it's wrong to carry anything on your shoulder. The idea was, I mean, if you happen to be carrying a pot from the fireplace, I mean, that's one thing. But if you're doing real work, if you have to hoist it up on your shoulder and carry it along, you see? Those were two of the 39 categories of prohibited work. And so in the controversy that eventually broke out whether or not God keeps the Sabbath, there was a whole controversy on that. The Jews were divided on it. One side said, well, obviously God doesn't keep the Sabbath. He's got to continue working. Because if he doesn't keep working, every seventh day, providence falls apart. I mean, he's no longer moving the pieces around. I mean, you no longer have an ordered universe. He's got to keep working. He can't stop all his work. And the other group argued in a variety of ways, yeah, but he must have kept the Sabbath. Surely. I mean, he gave the law, so he keeps his own laws, doesn't he? And when they were asked then how to explain the fact that this would mean that the whole universe would fly apart every Sabbath, they said, well, you must understand that God is so much bigger than the universe that even if he's moving things about, it's all within his own domicile. And he is so big that that never does he lift anything higher than his shoulders. As it were. I mean, they understood they were speaking metaphorically, but they were trying to show that there are ways within their own understanding of the work code that had God still ordering things, but still not prohibiting, not breaking any of the prohibitions on work, do you see? That's what they were trying to do. But that means that, in fact, both sides are acknowledging that God is still doing something on Sabbath. He's doing some work. And so what Jesus does here, he could have come back and simply said, oh, no, you guys aren't really understanding the halakhot properly, that is the rules of conduct properly, and had a whole theological debate with them and said, look, when I was doing some healing, it's not as if I'm a doctor earning my money by being a doctor, and I was doing a little extra on the Sabbath in order to earn some extra income, and I could have waited till the next day to heal that paralyzed man. It was a miracle, for goodness sake. He could have answered that, and they might have argued with him, but they wouldn't have been upset. And likewise, when he told the man to roll up his mat and take it home, probably put it on his shoulder and took it home, do you see? He could have said, look, this guy doesn't make a living by walking home with his mat. I mean, he's not breaking it. He's just going home after being healed, for goodness sake, do you see? If Jesus had answered along those sorts of lines, he wouldn't have got any flack. And they might not have liked it, but they wouldn't have accused him of blasphemy or anything. But instead, he ratchets up the whole debate to a Christological center. He says, my Father works until this very hour, and I too am working. So whatever exceptions the Jews made for God, Jesus is now claiming for himself. See? That's what ratchets up the whole debate and starts off the Christological controversy of the next verses. So this business of God working and Sabbath and so on, I mean, these controversies have been around in one form or another long before Christianity. They take different shapes in different periods of history, but they've been around a long time.
I thank you for taking questions, and I need your help. Because of our evangelism in Lancaster County, the Jewish community has brought in Messiah Truth. Hmm. And so in our debates with Messiah Truth, we come to the point of oral law and dealing with oral law only based on the five books of Moses. So at each time we would the Pharisees build on their righteousness. I said, well, all your righteousness is filthy rags. What is your answer? And they said, well, the answer is hidden from us at this point, but we were covered in the captivity. God forgave us our sins, and therefore this is another hiatus. Messiah has not come, and he is forgiving us our sins in this period too. In the last period, it was only our righteousness that God acknowledged, and therefore he is acknowledging our righteousness now, and the fact that he may have looked down from heaven on earth to see if there were any righteous, no, not one, doesn't mean anything. It comes secondary to the oral law. Then I go to the point, well, but Messiah had to come in the given period of Genesis 49:10. Well, it would seem that way. Every time you get something and you put it on the scripture, you say, well, it would seem that way, and we just don't understand that at this point. But it's still the continuum, and we are following that continuum. And I can't break to the point, I can't go into Psalm 95, because that is secondary to the oral law. So I can't find anything within Talmud, within Torah itself, to bring that to a conclusion to say, okay, other than Genesis 49:10, no Messiah was supposed to come. I said, well, it still requires blood. And then I went to the schools of Shammai and Hillel, which were both Pharisaic schools, and they admitted, yes, it's the blood that does it. And then they say, well, but they forgive us now because of our righteousness, because we're in another hiatus. And I don't know how to get past not using all scripture and the fact that they keep going back to the oral law, which in my study is changing anyway. I mean, we codify it in the Babylonian Talmud, but we're still getting updates. It's like Fred said, do you want an update on the CD? You know, it's still updates coming through. Or
let me answer this, because this could go on a long time, this one. Let me answer where you've got so far, if I may. Challenge them on Tanakh. That is to say, it's not just a question of Torah, it's Tanakh. Oral law is emerges as further oral debate out of Torah, that's correct. But Tanakh is the Hebrew canon. And for most Jews, that's also binding. For Samaritans, it's not. If you have a Samaritan group, it's only Torah. It's only Torah plus their form of oral law. But for Jews, you don't write off Tanakh. And if you're writing off Tanakh, or putting oral law even above Tanakh, you see, for a devout Jew, you're not supposed to put oral law above Tanakh. You're supposed to show how they work together, which is why Isaiah 53 is supposed to be important for them. They still have to explain it.
I understand that, but it's even come to the point that Reform rabbis are relying on oral law above Tanakh.
Yeah, and at that point, I would say that where that happens, you have to domesticate your own scriptures, don't you? Because you can't believe what they say at face value. I mean, I go after them hard.
Okay.
But beyond that, on occasion with Jews, what I've sometimes done is done exactly what Paul does. It's not so much what Hebrews does, because Hebrews is making a jump all the way from Torah to Psalms.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Paul can stay within Genesis. What do you do with Abraham? And it's his relationship to the law. Read the account sequentially. And then the argument of Galatians 3 becomes really quite important. But okay. I beyond all of that, one has to acknowledge that no matter how good your arguments are, I mean, even if your arguments are exactly right and sort of a neutral observer from Mars, we're saying, yeah, you win on points. At the end of the day, it doesn't guarantee that somebody's going to believe. They're none so blind as those who will not see. And it's not just with Jews. I mean, that's with everybody. The first time I met the woman who would become my wife was at an evangelistic meeting I was speaking at in Cambridge. And she was a graduate student in education. And let the record show, she was impressed neither by the message nor the messenger. It's a long story, but eventually, she was a roommate of a Christian girl whom we've supported for years now in the mission field, and I was doing a lot of I was a PhD student myself, and I was doing a lot of evangelism. And this girl would organize all of these postgraduate conferences and talk about this and that and the other. And Joy, my wife to be, was dragged along to these things, and she was bored right up to her eyeballs. She wasn't interested at all. And I finally challenged her, would she read something if I gave it to her? And she said, was it written by a Baptist? And I said, no, it was written by a decent C of E clergyman. You can't get safer than that. And so she said, well, I don't have much time. I said, I didn't ask you if you had much time. I asked you if you'd read it. I didn't ask you how fast you'd read it. And so eventually she promised she'd read it, and I gave her a copy of John Stott's Basic Christianity, which in those days was pretty good. And I didn't see her for months. And then I bumped into her on the street somewhere, and I said, did you read that book I gave you? And she said, yeah, and I looked up most of the references in the Bible, too. And I said, what did you make of it? And she said, I quote, I've decided that Christianity is okay for good people like you and Carol, but it's not for me. Now, I ask you, how does a graduate student at Cambridge University, which presumably means, you know, you're not an absolute twit, read somebody like Stott, who is immaculate in English prose, and certainly understands all about grace and all that, read Stott and look up the Bible verses, and come out and conclude that Christianity is for good people? You know, I could see scrolling up in front of my eyes, you know, the natural man does not understand the things of God for their foolishness to him, you know. I said, have you got time? She said, for what? I said, for a walk. And she said, where do you want to go? She says, not where I want to go. I said, what I want to say. And so she came along, and we went along the Cam, the River Cam, and for a two-hour walk in which I expounded justification. Talk about romance. To this day, she goes around telling people Don Carson was interested only in my soul and not my body.
Thank you.
All I'm saying is no matter how much you try, no matter how much you win, I mean, at the end of the day, you still have to pray that the Spirit of God will open the blind eyes, too, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, I lean on this side, so all the people on this side are getting the questions. I mean, does anybody get... Yeah. And the mic's over here too, you see. So you got a double incentive on that side and no incentive on this side. Pardon? Oh, you do anything you like with it. It's not my mic.
Don, could you please help us with some of alleged anti-Semitism in the Gospels, especially since, you know, you read from the Gospel of John. Just a little, that reference, you know, for fear of the Jews.
Yes.
I have two questions from my friend who has a hard time getting up here because of his knees, and I'll just read them, and then I'll sit down. What's the reason for the priesthoods being the basis of the law? Hebrews 7:11, the parenthesis. The reason for the priesthoods being the basis of the law. And then the second one, from my friend, what is the significance of Christ's being a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek? The word forever is underlined, Hebrews 7:17 and Psalm 110 and verse 4. And one fourth question, if you have time, who do you think wrote Hebrews?
Question number one. On anti-Semitism, there is a vast literature today on this subject, a multiplying literature on anti-Semitism, and a great number of writers today charge the New Testament with being the font of Western anti-Semitism. And thus Christians get blamed for the Holocaust and so forth. I was on BBC Radio last week, in fact, in Ireland, and that question came up again. You know, what do you say to people who insist that, after all, it's religion that causes wars, it's religion that causes difficulty? You know, at this point, we're at the height of the bombings in Palestine, Israel. And what I said then, I would say now, I would say that anybody who takes that position hasn't read much of the last 100 years of history. When you look at the bloody slaughter of the 20th century, two world wars and 50 million under Mao and 20 million under Stalin, and on and on and on, very little of it is caused by religion. I mean, Pol Pot, one-third of the population of Cambodia, was not motivated by religious things. And moreover, some of the stuff that is labeled religious is not really primarily religious. It's religio-cultural, tribal, and so on. I said, let's be quite frank. Here in Northern Ireland, which is where I was at the time, the disputes that take place between the Shankill Road and the Falls Road are not over the finer points of transubstantiation. You know, most of the yabos who were hurling gasoline bombs wouldn't know how to spell the word. it's a tribal stuff. It has more to do over the interpretation of the Battle of the Boyne than it does over transubstantiation. It's a tribal thing, and so I mean it's a false reading. And I mean, Hitler was not exactly your devoted Christian, you know, who was operating on profound Christian principles. And so to read history that way is in fact part of the new intolerance that masquerades as tolerance. So that needs to be said in very strong terms. In terms of the language of the New Testament itself, it's important to read it in its historical context. And most of the most virulent denunciations in the New Testament can be shown to have very equal parallels in the Old Testament. You know, the denunciations of Jews
in John are no stronger than the denunciation of Israelites by Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Amos, Hosea. And so, I mean, line for line, the New Testament is a bit softer. Moreover, sometimes the Jew language in John's gospel in particular means different things. And sometimes, transparently, what it means is Judeans, as opposed to Galilean Jews. In other words, it's a geographical thing. And occasionally, from the context, it means the Jewish leaders as opposed to the people at large, and so on. So to view it as first and foremost an anti-Jewish thing is profoundly mistaken. So a lot of the charge that comes out of publications from Princeton, in particular nowadays, Princeton's become a real center for anti-supersessionism, is the expression. What they are fighting is not anti-Semitism, but what they call anti-Judaism. So that anybody that criticizes Judaism is already on the verge of anti-Semitism. But that's really a subset of the larger postmodern pluralism that argues that you're really not allowed to criticize anybody. Everybody is equally right. And that's been worked out then in Hans Urs von Balthasar and people like that who are arguing that the New Testament itself is made up of two covenants. And one covenant is for the Jews and it's still in operation. And the other covenant is for Gentiles and that's in operation. So the Gentiles don't have the right to criticize the Jews and vice versa. So we can all become postmodernists and go home. It's very hard to read Hebrews that way. I mean, just extremely difficult to read Hebrews that way. And so there are publications that start arguing back and so on. I think that one of the hardest things we have to face in the secular culture nowadays is insisting that to say that somebody else is wrong is not to be intolerant. There has been a massive shift in the definition of tolerance in the last few years. Some universities have sort of public lectures where people come in and talk about anything, you know. And I'm now old enough that I occasionally get invited to do that kind of stuff. So the last three or four times when I've been invited to do it at University of Maryland and Queen's University Belfast and a few other places, I've chosen as my topic the intolerance of tolerance, and given a kind of intellectual history of tolerance. It used to be, for example, that tolerance. Tolerance presupposed that you could disagree with somebody, but you tolerated the individual. It was directed toward the individual. So the stance said, in effect, I may disagree to the nth degree with everything you are saying, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. Now, that was part of the Western heritage, you see, of tolerance. But under postmodern views, in which no view is ever allowed to be wrong, then to be tolerant means that you don't say anybody else is wrong. And if you say anybody else is wrong, then by definition, you're intolerant. So in polls, for example, done amongst university undergraduates, you picture two people, one of whom says that nobody is wrong, and the other of whom has very, very strong views about who's right and wrong, but insists that everybody has the right to speak, who is more tolerant, and 85% of undergraduates say that A is more tolerant. And the result of that, however, is that it's tolerance toward ideas and not to individuals. So if somebody actually comes along and says, I think that view of tolerance is wrong, by definition, you're intolerant. And thus, anybody with a strong desire to say anything in the public domain now becomes an intolerant person, especially in the domain of religion. And that sort of thing has to be explained again and again. I've had endless debates in universities just over the nature of tolerance. And it really becomes important in that kind of framework to argue with people very strongly until they get really angry and then say, do you tolerate my saying these things? And eventually the penny drops. And usually I get people to see what the issues are. And then you get by that. And then you say, now let's talk about the gospel. But I think that's a stance that we're going to face very widely in our culture in the next foreseeable future. And not just over Jewish anti-Semitism, but over questions of tolerance, intolerance in every domain. We are on the defensive now in the culture, whether we like it or not. We're not perceived to be on the front end of social reform and justice and all of that. We're perceived to be on the tail end of yesterday's epistemology. There's a lot more that could be said, but enough of that. On why am I supposed to stop here, Mr. Chairman? May I answer these last three questions, or do you want me to stop? On why the writer to the Hebrews should say that all of the covenant or all of the law covenant is based on
the priesthood. Strictly speaking, the text doesn't answer that question. I mean, it doesn't say, it doesn't give us the answer to that question. So one must always be careful to go beyond what the text says. It does insist that it is the case. That is non-negotiable. So just because you may not be able to give a foolproof answer to that second question does not give you the right to overturn the primary question. The primary question is, does the passage insist that the law covenant is based on the priestly structure? Yes. Now, you start from there. Now, after that, then you can offer some suggestions, it seems to me, that are useful. One is the fact that the question itself already presupposes another answer. And that is an answer that comes out of Western emphasis on jurisprudence, on law, on the significance of law. Do you see? Whereas the question already itself brings its own agenda. But all I'm saying is, if we can abstract ourselves from that agenda for a wee bit and just look at the Old Testament passages, on the face of it, they spend far, far, far more time on priestly, sacrificial, tabernacle, consecration, holiness, unholiness, holiness code, sorts of things in the Torah than everything else put together. So even in terms of space and priority, and now on the past, you know, we sort of skirt over that and say, well, the fundamental thing is moral law. Well, it is worth reckoning that although the tripartite distinction, moral, civil, ceremonial law, you can find traces of it all the way back to the fathers. Nevertheless, as a model for explaining the relationships between the testaments, I haven't been able to trace it back farther than Thomas Aquinas. Calvin gets it from Thomas. Calvin gets a lot of things from Thomas, in fact. And on that particular one, he's a Thomist. I don't think it can be tracked back farther, at least I haven't been able to track it back farther than Thomas. So it's not that you don't have those categories elsewhere, but as a full-blown explanation for how you explain what continues and does not continue from covenant to covenant, it's a Thomistic reconstruction. In other words, these are not categories that are found in the New Testament. In the New Testament, or the Old Testament, when you compare law with law, clearly there are some things that are more important than other things. That's true. So there are weightier matters and lighter matters. For example, in Matthew 23:23, on the matter of tithing, these ought you to have done and not to have left the others undone. Some are more weighty than others. And so you can ask the question in the New Testament, what's the most important commandment? So there are relativities that are worked out. But as a whole system of sorting out what continues and what doesn't continue, the tripartite structure, in fact, is Thomistic, rather than something that emerges naturally out of the pages of the New Testament. And that means that when you look at that particular parenthetical expression in Hebrews 7, 11, and 12, it seems to me that we should come in from a different stance. If the text says this, and it does, then start saying, well, yeah, does that make sense? I mean, if we abstract ourselves from our own biases, does it make sense just by reading the Old Testament? And you have to start saying, in point of fact, it does. I mean, if you remove everything that has priestly structure from Torah, how much have you got left, for goodness sake? I mean, you really do see that the whole structure of the thing collapses if you remove that center reality. And it also is a reflection of the fact, I think, that more important than word, in one sense, is the whole priestly activity. Now, the word attests to the priestly activity. You can't know about the priestly activity apart from word. But in fact, it's the whole priestly activity which gives you the sacrificial system that points to Christ and so on, so on, so on. You see, the word is referring. The word refers to certain things. The reason I think that that's important is doubled today because of the so-called Yale School. Are you familiar with the Yale School of Theology, people like Lindbeck and so on? You read Lindbeck, and they're saying things like this. We ought to read the Bible more. We ought to have it shape our imagination. We ought to understand that if you memorize the Bible, it teaches you how to think, and on and on and on. We're saying, yes, 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 coming out of Yale, yes, yes, yes. And then you read on. What you're discovering is that he is a sufficient postmodernist that he does not think that you can say that the Bible is referring to something. So he refuses to say things that are objectively true about the God who is there, to use Schaeffer's old expression, because he just thinks that the Bible ought to shape our imagination, so on and so on, without saying that the Bible is telling the truth about stuff that is outside the Bible. The question is extra-textual referentiality. That is the text referring to something outside itself? And we are not saved by ideas in the Bible. We are saved, rather, by the realities outside the Bible about which the Bible tells us the true ideas. You see, you're not saved by ideas about Jesus, you're saved by Jesus. And likewise, even in the Old Testament, you see, you're not saved by ideas about the priestly system. The means of grace are mediated to you by the priestly system. So as important as you make the Bible, you better not make it an end in itself. That really is bibliolatry. In fact, if I have enough birthdays, I want to write a long, cheeky essay sometime called The Bibliolatry of George Lindbeck. It'll drive him bananas. But you see, the most right-wing fundamentalist isn't guilty of bibliolatry, because the right-wing fundamentalist is still insisting that the Bible, even if he's a Ruckmanite, that the Bible is still referring to something outside the Bible. Do you see? Whereas Lindbeck won't get you outside the Bible. And that's a postmodern trap. And I think that we sometimes imbibe enough of that by our insistence on the Bible that we almost think that we're saved by the Bible itself. And we're not saved by the Bible. We're saved by the things that the Bible is referring to and talking about, truly. That's the second question. Third question. What does forever mean? Forever simply means forever. That is, you are priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. The text, as we saw last night, although I was going fast enough that it may not have been obvious, and I'm sorry for that. There are several things that are drawn from that. One is the fact that this is the fulfillment of the Davidic promise in 2 Samuel 7 that ultimately that kingdom goes on and on and on and on and on. That either means you have a replacing king, replacing king, replacing king, replacing king, or eventually a king who lasts forever. And then likewise, over against the Levitical priesthood, which has to be replaced and replaced and replaced and replaced and replaced and replaced. Now you have a priest who lives forever. He's a priest forever. He doesn't have to be succeeded. And that's precisely why he can save to the uttermost all those who come to God by him. So it has pastoral implications as well as fulfillment implications, and it's one of the things that makes the Melchizedekian priesthood superior to the Levitical priesthood. And typologically, it's already prefigured in the fact that Melchizedek himself has nothing reported of him as of his beginning or ending and so on. Last question, who wrote Hebrews? Don't know.
I think I speak in behalf of everybody, Dr. Carson, that we not only appreciate what you say, we even like the way you say it. We invited him back next year. I hope he comes.